From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The architect, Karl Rove.
President Bush's top advisor, Karl Rove, is confident the Republican Party will retain control of Congress in the midterm elections. Does Rove know something the rest of the country doesn't? We'll speak with Texas journalist James Moore about his new book, The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power. First, running against Sodom and Osama, we'll take a look at the Christian right values voters in the culture wars in 2006. We'll also go to Gaza, where Israel's launched one of its largest military assaults in recent months. And we head to Oaxaca to find out the latest there. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Press reports out of Mexico indicate the gunmen suspected of murdering New York journalist Brad Will are missing, that they're not in police custody. The 36-year-old Brad Will died on Friday after being shot by paramilitaries in Oaxaca. He had his video camera in his hand. Photos taken at the time of the shooting show the armed men who carried out the attack. They've been identified as local police officers and government officials. Initially, a local mayor said five men had been detained, but the Mexican papers Milenio and Noticias de Oaxaca are now reporting no arrests have been made. We'll go to Oaxaca for a report after headlines. The U.S. military has announced the deaths of two more soldiers in Iraq for October. The month's toll is now 105, the fourth highest total since the U.S.-led invasion. Meanwhile, Reuters is reporting the Iraq Interior Ministry recorded an 18% increase in civilian deaths from September. The figures are considered incomplete because the ministry did not include all violent deaths. An Arizona public radio station has uncovered new details on the death of one of the first female U.S. soldiers to die in the Iraq War. KANU Radio reports Army Specialist Alyssa Peterson took her own life after objecting to interrogation techniques used on Iraqi prisoners. Peterson was assigned to a U.S. air base in Tal Afar. She died September 15, 2003, from what the military called a non-hostile weapons discharge. But newly uncovered documents say investigators actually concluded Peterson shot and killed herself with her service rifle. The documents also show Peterson's death came after she refused to take part in further interrogations after just 2 days. Military officials refused to describe what techniques Peterson had objected to and said all records of them had been destroyed. Specialist Peterson was 27 years old. In other Iraq news, a new poll shows Americans favor a specific timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops by a margin of almost 2-1. According to Princeton University Survey Research Associates, 61% of Americans are in favor of a timetable for withdrawal. 30% are opposed. Meanwhile, a New York Times CBS poll shows less than one-third of Americans approve of President Bush's handling of the Iraq war, while just one-fifth believe the U.S. is winning it. In the occupied territories, at least three Palestinians have been killed, more than 15 wounded, on the second day of a major Israeli offensive in Gaza. The dead include a 70-year-old Palestinian man shot by Israeli troops when he tried to take his disabled son inside their home. The violence comes one day after eight Palestinians and an Israeli soldier died during clashes on Wednesday. The raid's one of Israel's biggest operations since reinvading Gaza last June. We'll have more from Gaza later in the broadcast. More than 100 Guantanamo prisoners are challenging a key component of President Bush's new military commissions law. Attorneys filed a motion Wednesday arguing the military's authority to arrest people overseas and prevent them from challenging their detentions in U.S. courts is unconstitutional. Also Wednesday, a bipartisan group of seven retired federal judges filed a brief arguing the new rules would allow authorities to use evidence obtained by torture. The judges wrote, quote, "We believe that compelling this court to sanction executive detentions based on evidence that has been condemned in the American legal system since our nation's founding erodes the vital role of the judiciary in safeguarding the rule of law." At the United Nations, Guatemala and Venezuela have ended their deadlock over an open seat on the UN Security Council. Neither country was able to achieve a two-thirds majority after nearly 50 rounds of voting. Venezuela accused the U.S. of meddling in the race by openly campaigning for Guatemala. The two countries say they've chosen Panama as a compromise candidate. The German military is facing a new scandal in Afghanistan. The German weekly Stern has published a photograph of soldiers driving a car sporting a Nazi-like emblem. The emblem similar to one used by Nazi Germany's Afrika Korps during the Second World War. The new photo comes a week after images surfaced of German troops desecrating human remains, including skulls, in Afghanistan. In France, more than 70 Muslim workers have been stripped of their security clearances at the country's main airport. Officials at Charles de Gaulle Airport say some of the staff members visited terrorist training camps in Pakistan and Afghanistan. A group of workers has filed suit claiming discrimination. Here in the United States, Democratic Senator John Kerry has apologized for a self-described botched joke that said uneducated Americans wind up as U.S. troops stuck in Iraq. Kerry claims he meant to say if students didn't study, they would end up like President Bush and get the nation stuck in Iraq.
This was directed at the people who didn't do their homework, didn't listen to history, didn't listen to their own advice, and they owe the American people an apology. Now, I'm coming back to Washington today so that I'm not a distraction, because I don't want to be a distraction to these campaigns. And the point is simply they owe America an apology for this disaster in Iraq, and I hope they're going to provide it.
In an interview on the program Imus on the Radio, Kerry also announced he'll stop campaigning for Democratic candidates and return to Washington to avoid being a distraction in the elections. McClatchy newspapers reporting the State Department has been screening the views of individuals for criticism of the Bush administration before sending them on foreign speaking assignments. The State Department Inspector General says the practice amounts to, quote, virtual censorship. In one case, a conflict resolution expert was excluded from a video conference in Jerusalem after it was discovered he wrote a book critical of the U.S.-led reconstruction of Iraq. The screenings could violate federal guidelines that mandate the State Department provide a broad range of speakers abroad that are, quote, not limited to the expression of U.S. government policies. In Maryland, an appeals court has issued a controversial ruling over how rape is defined in the state. A three-judge panel ruled Monday sexual penetration can't be considered rape if intercourse has begun and consent has been given. The ruling threw out a rape conviction on the grounds the judge should have told the presiding jury that a woman cannot withdraw her consent after the start of sexual intercourse. The Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault has called the decision, quote, insulting and dangerous. The U.S. Air Force is requesting an unprecedented $50 billion in funding for next year. The request amounts to half its annual budget. Defense sources told The Washington Post the extra funds would help pay to transport growing numbers of U.S. soldiers killed and wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. The engineering giant Bechtel has announced it's leaving Iraq after more than 3 years. The San Francisco-based company has been awarded more than $2 billion in Iraq contracts since the U.S.-led invasion. And finally, two government agencies have begun an investigation into whether the Bush administration has suppressed government scientists' work on global warming. The inspectors general at NASA and the Commerce Department are looking into whether administration officials prevented climate researchers from making their findings public. In January, leading climate scientist James Hansen said NASA officials had ordered a review all of his upcoming lectures, papers, writings, and requests for interviews from journalists. The results of the probe are expected early next year. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Press reports out of Mexico indicate the gunmen suspected of murdering New York journalist Brad Will are missing, that they are not in police custody. Brad Will died Friday after being shot by paramilitaries in Oaxaca. The 36-year-old indie media journalist had his video camera in his hand. Photos taken at the time of the shooting show the armed men who carried out the attack. They've been identified as local police officers and government officials. Initially, the local mayor said the five men had been detained, But the Mexican papers Milenio and Noticias de Oaxaca are now reporting no arrests have been made. John Gibler is on the line with us from Oaxaca, an independent journalist and human rights fellow with Global Exchange. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Thank you. Good morning.
What is the latest?
The latest news on the killers is indeed that they are missing. As a result of a Milenio investigation, we were unable to locate their whereabouts anywhere in the city of Oaxaca. I went yesterday to the scene of the shootings and interviewed several people there. They said that they were still in town and were actually at a house just four blocks away from where the shootings occurred, but they wouldn't take me there but for very obvious reasons, fear for their safety. I interviewed several people on the scene who were witness to the attacks and went against what the local chair of the city council had said, that the gunmen acted on their own and in self-defense. The governor of the state, Ulysses Ruiz, has said that the men have been arrested, but that has now been proven to be false.
And so what are the local mayors saying? It was mayors who had announced that they had been arrested.
Exactly. Manuel Feria, who's the chair of the city council in Santa Lucia, where the shootings occurred, he says that the APO had initiated the attacks, the members of the Oaxaca People's Assembly shooting at these police officers and trying to violently break into a property where they were located, which has been... people I've interviewed on the scene, everyone has gone against that, saying that the people had, the gunmen had come through, tried to break through a barricade and gotten out of a pickup truck and opened fire first at the barricade, and that the gunfire had then spread to several locations surrounding blocks. It's also important to remember that there were several shootouts simultaneously that day in different parts of the city.
John Gibler, this situation right now in Oaxaca, Brad Will, the New York indie media journalist, is not the only person who died this weekend. In fact, on Friday night, weren't there three others, Mexicans, who died? And then when the federal police moved in force on Sunday, also there were casualties.
Absolutely. And one of the most, I think, kind of powerful, symbolically powerful actions of the Oaxaca People's Assembly and their movement has been to take up the traditional Day of the Dead ceremonies here in Mexico and use them as a form of protest. They called 2 days ago for people to build Day of the Dead altars in honor of the people who've been killed throughout the 5 months of conflict in different barricades across the city, reinforcing the symbolic power of their barricades and the maintenance of the barricades, the way of defying the federal police intervention and saying that the protesters still have control of the city. Even though they can't build their traditional sand sculptures in the Zocalo, as they've done every year for decades, if not longer, they've been building the altars throughout the city. And it's definitely important to mention that one of the most frequently honored people at these altars across Oaxaca City, and especially in Santa Lucia, is Brad Will.
And what do you expect is going to take place right now, now that the president of Mexico has moved in the federal police?
They're really at a deadlock because the protesters are not backing down, but to many people's surprise, neither are they confronting the police. They're maintaining a strategy of nonviolence. They've called people to lift barricades without resistance when the police came in or come in, such was the case yesterday with two police incursions against barricades, but they're not going away. They're holding marches daily, organizing barricades, and taking, for example, the traditional ceremonies of Day of the Dead and incorporating them into their protests, which puts the federal government in an incredibly binding position to either crack down with violence against the protesters or to force the exit or the ouster of Ulysses Ruiz.
Well, I want to thank you very much, John Gibler, for joining us, speaking to us from Oaxaca, an independent journalist there. Brad's body is on its way to his family in Wisconsin. There will be a memorial service for Brad in New York City at St. Mark's Church between 1 and 5 p.m. on November 11th. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we turn now to the occupied territories, where at least three Palestinians have been killed and more than 15 wounded in northern Gaza Thursday, on the second day of a major Israeli offensive. The dead include a 70-year-old Palestinian man who was shot in the head by Israeli troops when he went onto the balcony of his home to take his disabled son inside. 8 Palestinians and an Israeli soldier died during clashes Wednesday. The raids, one of Israel's biggest operations since reinvading Gaza last June. Helicopter gunships fired missiles onto the town of Beit Hanun. Tanks patrolled the streets, snipers took up rooftop positions, and troops conducted house-to-house searches. Both the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and the Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh have described the Israeli military action as a massacre. Israeli forces have made regular incursions into Gaza over the past 4 months, following the capture of an Israeli soldier in late June by Palestinian militants. Since then, over 300 Palestinians, the majority of them civilian, have been killed. Three Israeli soldiers have also been killed. We go now to Gaza to speak to Jennifer Lowenstein, a visiting research fellow at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University. She's working on a book about the transformation of national Palestinian movement. She joins us on the phone right now from Gaza City. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jennifer.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Jennifer, you last were in Gaza almost 2 years ago. How has it changed?
The situation, it's very interesting. I mean, it's kind of surreal. I was here in January, and it's always sort of dreary in the wintertime. And I say that because you get into Gaza, and it's this beautiful, bright blue cerulean sky and this flowered foliage, and it's gorgeous. And then you look beyond that at the city itself, and it's absolutely crumbling, and there is trash in the street. And destruction everywhere. I mean, buildings that have been bombed or simply falling apart out of disrepair. There are shops that are virtually empty. There are power cuts every single day. That was common, but not anywhere near as common as it is now. There are places where people have electricity for 2 or 3 hours a day only. That's significant, particularly because you need to have electricity to pump water to the upper floors of these apartment buildings. And so a lot of people end up with absolutely no water for a number of days at a time. I've been here many times. In fact, I lived here in 2002 for almost half a year. And it's never been normal here. It's never been easy. But in all of the times I've returned to the Gaza Strip, I have not ever seen it look this collapsed, this exhausted. You see it not only in the buildings and in the appearance, the grayness and the crumbling appearance, but you also see it in the faces of people. And, you know, the Gazans, in my opinion, in any case, have been very, very strong people and very defiant and persistent people. And yet, person after person that I've talked to this time has expressed real despair, real frustration, the belief that things are not going to get better, that this is not going to change. And it's very discouraging to hear that and to see people with such hopelessness.
Jennifer Lowenstein, how did you get into Gaza? How hard is it to be there? You're a visiting research fellow at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University.
It's extremely difficult to get into Gaza. I'm sure that the reason is because the Israeli authorities are keenly aware that when people see how it looks here, that it would automatically win sympathy in the outside world. So what's interesting is that if I trace my ability to get into Gaza back to the year 2001 when I first came, it's gotten progressively harder and harder and harder to get back in. In 2004, for example, it took me 5 days to get a press card from the Israelis, even though I had my own valid press card. But because I was an independent freelance journalist at the time, I was suspicious. And because I wasn't working for a major Western and, I should say, sympathetic media outlet, I was given a lot of hassle. People from the Beit Agron, the press house in West Jerusalem, even called the Israeli consulate in Chicago, which then called contacts of mine in Madison to find out who I was and whether or not I should be let in. I shouldn't say contacts of mine, but people I know. In that particular situation, I know from one of the rabbis in Madison who told me sympathetically later on that the executive director of the Madison Jewish Community Center informed the consulate that I was dangerous and should not be allowed in. I was nevertheless given a press card the last 2 days I was here, so I was able to do something, but it was very little. Now it is impossible for freelancers to come in at all. They have prohibitive fees, and basically the only people who can get in from the media are people who are full-time correspondents, Middle East correspondents, for a nationally recognized paper or station such as the New York Times, the BBC, the London Times. These are the kinds of people who can come in. Other journalists have a great deal of difficulty. Now this time, and I think this is also significant, the only way for individuals to come in is to receive some kind of sponsorship from either a United Nations organization or a well-known international human rights organization such as Save the Children or Amnesty International. They are given clearance. So for me, I started last April trying to apply to come in. And because I work as a researcher at an international organization, the Refugee Studies Center, UNSCO, the United Nations Special Coordinator's Office, did agree to sponsor my research. That was in June, and so I came immediately. Nonetheless, when I arrived, it was on June 25th, the same day that Gilad Shalit was kidnapped. And as a result, nobody got in, nobody for the entire week, except these quote-unquote sympathetic journalists. So I had to return now because my clearance is up as of tomorrow. But so the hassle, the attempt to come in here is difficult for people to imagine. When I arrived in June at the Tel Aviv airport, I didn't say anything to the woman behind the desk where they check in all the passengers from the flights. I handed her my passport. She typed the number in my passport into her computer, and within seconds, I was surrounded by Israeli security personnel who said, "Come with us, please." And at that point, I didn't know if I was even going to be allowed into the country. I was detained, searched, and interrogated over a period of 6.5 hours, and had really nobody told me whether I was going to be let in or not. And at the end, I was simply escorted through the airport and let go, but only after asking questions and being completely given a body search and having every item of my luggage examined meticulously.
Jennifer Lowenstein, we only have a minute to go, but this latest news right now out of Gaza, in this raid, one of Israel's biggest operations since re-invading Gaza last June. At least 3 Palestinians have been killed, more than 15 wounded in Gaza in the second day of the offensive. The dead include a 70-year-old man who went out on his balcony to bring in his disabled son. The deaths coming one day after 8 Palestinians and an Israeli soldier died in clashes yesterday. Can you describe the situation? Are you able to get around to investigate?
Only to the extent that I've gotten to the hospital. I was in the Shifa Hospital in Gaza City yesterday deliberately because of this incursion. And by the way, it was 9 Palestinians yesterday. They're very careful about documenting things here. I went around and, with the permission of one of the head doctors at the hospital, photographed the wounded, because I know from being an American citizen that we don't see Palestinian dead and wounded. We only see the Israelis. And so I was taken to various wards in the hospital where people were recovering, in particular the intensive care unit, and photographed people with bullet wounds and with legs and arms bound up in plaster. And in one case, a man had, was simply bleeding from his belly. I mean, it was really truly gruesome. And one of the people had died on the operating table that morning and was taken to the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Hanun, where they take the dead. There were lots of relatives hanging around the hospital waiting for news on their relatives. And just as an aside, it was very touching because, you know, you walk through these hospitals on a very hot and very humid Gaza day. There is no air conditioning. There are no proper bed linens. One father was shouting at one of the nurses that his son had been there a week. This was in another case, and had not yet had changed bed linens. And the doctor was telling me, look, we don't have them. We don't have basic supplies like that. We don't have dialysis machines for kidney patients. We don't have cancer drugs. We can't do elective surgeries anymore, such as for hernias or anything like that, because the more crucial or urgent situations have to take precedence. They don't have basic medicines for people with the flu and you know, stomach upset. It's really a serious and deadly siege that's been imposed on the Gaza Strip, and it's having incredibly bad repercussions here among the population.
Finally, Jennifer, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the Bush administration has undertaken efforts to arm and train the presidential guard of the Palestinian Authority chair, Mahmoud Abbas, in order to prepare it for a potential violent conflict with Hamas. Palestinian sources say the training started in August under the guidance of an American military instructor. Do you have any more information on this?
Yes, I do, and I think it's another very important point. There's no question that this has happened. Nobody is shocked or surprised to hear it. They all know it. They all tell me this has been going on for a long time. There are training camps set up by the U.S. in the West Bank near Jericho, where these security forces are being trained. And there is clearly a circle of people around Abbas, not necessarily Abbas himself, but around Abbas, people such as Mohammed Dahlan, who have never accepted the Hamas government itself in any case and have been provoking skirmishes since January, basically, between the two factions. What is significant, however, is that this group of people around Abbas has no popular support. In fact, their support is dropped even further, even more below the situation in January when the elections when the election results came in and Hamas had gotten a victory, Fatah, of course, being defeated for the first time in its history. Nobody here wants a civil war. The people are against it. Everybody you talk to says, no, it's not going to happen. But there's no question that this particular force around Abbas, these people being trained by the Americans, could cause a lot of trouble. It simply won't be something that reaches into the population, because there is simply no popular support, nor are there the grounds for a real civil war here. Nobody wants it.
Jennifer Lowenstein, I want to thank you for being with us, visiting research fellow at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University, currently in Gaza City, where she is speaking to us from. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
ما كلني وانا عايش ببلادي قتلني زي ما تلت اجدادي
اجل الخنون
على الفاضي ما انت يا عدو بتلعب دور الشاهد المحامي والقاضي علي قاضي نهايتي بادي حلمك انقل فوق معنى آلية حلمك لآلية تصير بالمقابر اخطارية ديمقراطية
والله انكم ناسية
من كثر ما اغتصبتوا النفس العربية
هبلت ولدت
ولد اسمه عملية انفجارية وهنا ديتنا ارهابية يعني ضربتني وبكيت سبعتني واشتكيت لما ذكرتك انك بديت
نطيت وحكيت
ما انتوا بتخلوا ولاد صغار يرموا حجار ما لهمش اهل يدبوهم بالدار ايش كنه نسيت انه استحق ضب الاهل تحت الحجار وهلا لما وجع الفار بتناديني ارهابي
مين ارهابي انا ارهابي كيف ارهابي وانا عايش في بلادي مين ارهابي انت ارهابي ماكلني وانا عايش في بلادي
ليش ارهابي عشان دمي مش هادي حامي عشان رافع راسي وارض بلادي قتلوا حبايبي
انا لحالي
اهلي تشردوا
راح اضلي انادي
انا مش ضد السلام السلام ضدي علي بده يقضي تراثي بده يمحي واللي بيحكي كلمه بشد ورا همه بيكون زلمه
تعملوا منه رمه
ومين انتوا لسه امتى خبرتوا اتصلوا قديش قتلتوا قديش شتمتوا امياتنا بيبكوا ابياتنا بيشكوا اراضينا بيخطفوا
انا بقولكم مين انتوا
انتوا خبرتوا بدلا احنا كبرنا فقر من كبر في وسع ومن كبر في جحر صار في داعي عملتوا منه اجرامي
Who's a terrorist? The Palestinian hip-hop group Dom. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting over 500 radio and television stations around the country, as well as on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. We also want to welcome a new station to Democracy Now!'s extended family, our first station in Oklahoma, KUCO-TV, Channel Channel 6 at the University of Central Oklahoma in Edmond, now airing Democracy Now! Three times a day. As we approach the midterm elections next Tuesday, our Democracy Now! Election coverage continues. On November 7th, several states will vote on ballot measures to ban same-sex marriage. Republicans are hoping this will boost turnout of conservative Christian voters in crucial congressional races. In the 2004 presidential elections, the Christian right mobilized voters to come out and vote for President Bush. According to exit polls, white, evangelical, or born-again Christians made up a quarter of the electorate, and 78% of them voted Republican. This September, 1,700 Christian right grassroots activists gathered in Washington, D.C. for the Values Voter Summit, which was built around the slogan, Family, Faith, and freedom. Speakers like James Dobson, a focus on the family, openly boasted of meeting Republican leaders in the prior weeks and reminded the audience of the major role the Christian right plays in electing Bush. The event also showcased 2008 presidential hopefuls, Senator George Allen, who's been running a very close race in Virginia. A new article looks at how the 2004 strategy of the religious right has been revived for this election. In running against Sodom and Osama, the Christian right values voters and the culture wars in 2006, writers Chip Berlett and Pam Chamberlain write, quote, "Although leaders of the Christian right almost universally deny it, the goal of this revived campaign is to elect Republicans to office. The enemy being denounced is sometimes generic, gays, liberals, secularists, left-leaning media, and Hollywood, and sometimes specific, Ted Kennedy, Nancy Pelosi, Rosie O'Donnell, and the ACLU. But the actual target is the Democratic Party and its candidates." Chip Berlett now joins us from Boston, senior analyst at Political Research Associates and co-writer of the article. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Chip.
Good morning.
What do you think is most important now to understand about evangelical voters?
Well, first, that not all evangelical voters are part of the Christian right, but the Christian right hasn't gone away. Even though the Christian coalition has collapsed, there's a new coalition that's been formed to mobilize voters to get out and vote for Republicans. And while there was some confusion after the 2004 election about the role of conservative Christian evangelical voters, in Ohio and some other states, they clearly did make a difference. And some recent, more in-depth statistical work has shown that it's geographically defined, that in some key states, the Christian right did make a difference in that election.
Can you talk about the various sectors of evangelicals? Who comes out to vote? Who doesn't? And what are the different concerns of these sectors?
Well, like most Americans, many evangelicals just don't vote at all. So that's pretty much similar with the entire population. If you look at evangelicals in general, you have to make a distinction between black evangelicals who vote 95% for Democrats versus white evangelicals who, as you pointed out, are more in the 75-78 range for Republicans. But there is a portion of these voters that generally vote Republican who can be swing voters in certain elections, primarily if they think issues like the economy or health care or poverty trump issues like abortion and gay marriage.
And how important are the anti-gay marriage initiatives in the country right now in this election to get out evangelical voters?
Well, it seems that in 2004, they did draw voters to the polls, and those voters generally voted for Bush. So I think the strategy has been to launch these referendums across the country and use that as a maneuver to bring conservative evangelicals to the polls. And then these two conferences, the Value Voters Summit in Washington, D.C. in late September, and then Liberty Sunday here in Boston in October, are designed to ramp up the rhetoric. And there was really some nasty rhetoric at the Value Voters Summit. A group of us from Political Research went down there, and we were very shocked by the really nasty homophobic rhetoric that was coming out. And it was clear that there had been a decision made to go back to the earlier nasty rhetoric that you could see in the Christian right in the early 1980s, for instance, that had been kind of suppressed for a while with a kinder, gentler kind of anti-gay organizing. And they've really launched a vicious campaign this time around.
We're talking to Chip Berlett, who co-authored a piece called Running Against Sodom and Osama, Sodom being S-O-D-O-M. Why'd you title the piece this?
Well, it's a pun because you can think of Saddam Hussein and Obama, but Sodom was the town which, in the Bible, the conservative evangelicals who don't support gay rights say is an example of God's punishment for sexual wickedness. So what we have here is a connection being made at these meetings between Osama bin Laden and Islamic terrorism as a threat to the American family, just like at home, domestically, homosexuals and gay marriage are a threat to the American family. And it's this pairing of the idea that just like a bomb tears apart the family, so does gay marriage. Now, it's nonsensical to most people who support gay rights, but within the conservative evangelical context, it provokes a very powerful image of protecting hearth and home domestically from, you know, rapacious and, you know, child-molesting gay people, which is the stereotype that is a subtext of much of this, and the increasingly bigoted framing of Muslims as all terrorists and perhaps even part of the Antichrist's reign in the end times that a lot of conservative evangelicals have adopted.
Chipperle, how does the whole scandal around former Congressmember Foley fit into this, which brings together all of these different issues? Also, just heard that, you know, his 30 days in alcohol treatment is over, but he's not going to leave. I mean, obviously, it's right before the election, and he would be getting a lot of attention if he walked out of a clinic right now.
Well, like everyone else, evangelicals are shocked by his actions, and it causes a kind of a split. But it can go two ways. It can get some conservative evangelicals angry at Republicans for having tolerated it. But what's the alternative? Vote for Democrats who support gay rights? So it may just get them motivated to come out and vote for new Republicans. So it's really not clear. This is a very complicated election. A lot of conservative evangelicals support the idea of the war on terrorism, especially when it's tied to this stereotype of Muslim terrorism. But they're really not happy with the war in Iraq because so many of the people that are in their family have gone over there, and they don't see it working very well as a war effort. So it's really kind of hard to tell how either the Foley scandal or the war in Iraq is going to play among conservative evangelicals at this point.
Chipperle, the issue of is the support dropping, even in the most core group that the Republican Party has so long depended on? According to the Pew Research Center, 57% of white evangelicals say they'll likely vote Republican this year, a 21% drop from 2 years ago.
And that's one reason why this campaign has been launched. There has been polling that shows a tremendous dissatisfaction with Republicans. But what religious right leaders who put together this conference, it was, you know, James Dobson from the American Family Association, Tony Perkins with the Family Research Council, Donald Wildman of the American Family Association, Gary Bauer of Americans United to Save Marriage. All of these groups have got together to say, yes, you're unhappy with the Republicans, so are we, but what's the alternative? And just like those people, you know, who faced down the terrorists and the planes on 9/11, you should go to the polls and vote Republican. And they literally said that. They used the image of 9/11 and saying, just as Americans stood up against terrorism on 9/11, you need to stand up against gay marriage in this election. So the last few days are very important, and there are these networks of evangelical pastors that have been formed in several key states, and they may play a very important role in turning out voters at the last minute. It's really, again, hard to guess, but people shouldn't write off the power of the Christian right to mobilize evangelical voters.
And do you think that the left has something to learn from the organizing within the evangelical movement, and what is that?
Well, that grassroots organizing is key, and that too many political organizations and progressive social movement organizations have given up on door-to-door kind of neighborhood organizing and local organizing, and that really, when it comes to real social change, that grassroots organizing makes the difference. Social movements pull political parties in their direction when they're strong. If you don't have a powerful progressive movement, it doesn't matter how much you want the Democrats to do what you want them to do.
Chipperle, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Senior analyst at Political Research Associates in Somerville, Massachusetts. We'll link to the report. It's called Running Against Sodom and Osama, The Christian Right Values Voters in the Culture Wars in 2006. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, the architect, Karl Rove, and the master plan for absolute power. Stay with us.
Free. Christian cannons have fired at my days, with a warning beneath the holy blaze, and bow to our authority, say the canons of Christianity. Oh, the children will be sent to schools, minds of clay are molded to the rules. Learn to fear all of eternity, warn the canons of Christianity. Holy hands will count the money raised, like a king the Lord is richly praised on a cross of diamond majesty, say the canons of Christianity. Missionaries will travel on crusades, the word is given, the heathen souls are saved. Conversion to our morality, sigh the canons of Christianity.
The canons of Christianity, Phil Oakes here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Washington Post recently reported there's widespread panic amidst the Republican establishment about next week's midterm elections. But the paper found there are two people whose confidence about Republican prospects strikes even their closest allies as almost inexplicably upbeat. They're President Bush and his top political adviser, Karl Rove. Last week, Rove told National Public Radio's Robert Siegel about why he remains so optimistic.
Unlike the general public, I'm allowed to see the polls on the individual races. And after all, this does come down to individual contests between individual candidates. I'm looking at all of these, Robert, and adding them up, and I add up to a Republican Senate and a Republican House. You may end up with a different math, but you're entitled to your math. I'm entitled to the math.
Karl Rove's comments have led many to ask whether he knows something the rest of the country doesn't. To help answer that question, we're joined by journalist James Moore in Austin, Texas, co-author of the new book, The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power. He's also co-author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. James Moore, welcome to Democracy Now! What do you think Karl Rove is talking about?
Well, there's no doubt, Amy, and this has happened historically, and Karl knows it better than probably most of us, that within a national race like this, you can get into local districts and you can have a dynamic in a local election in a congressional district that drives an election and is completely disconnected from what's going on nationally. Now, the problem is that when Karl Rove says these kinds of things, it immediately spawns conspiracy theories and a number of other things related to electronic voting and voter suppression and any number of other things that he has a confidence that they can turn an election and keep it, quote unquote, close enough to steal. Whether Karl Rove knows bad things that the rest of us don't know is what's causing a lot of people concern right now.
You talk about how Karl Rove was integral to the creating the pretext for war, for the invasion. Can you talk about what he did around the issue of information, propaganda, misinformation?
Well, what happened with Karl when the 9/11 attack occurred, Karl was in on the planning very early on. From before the president was elected, there was talk about Iraq and what must be done about Iraq, about the oil resources. Karl was in on that from the beginning, Amy. And when 9/11 happened, not just Karl Rove and the president and Donald Rumsfeld and the vice president, Dick Cheney, they all saw an opportunity to take that event and frame it in a way that gave them the chance and the resources and the political and public support to do something that they had intended to do anyway, which was to somehow find a way and a reason
to project United States military power and U.S. influence into the Middle East and to put us on the ground in the Middle East where all of those critical oil resources are. The president's belief was, and continues to be, that regardless of whether there were WMD or not, that there was a madman standing on top of what may be the world's largest supply, the largest reserves of oil. It was Carl's job to take a failed domestic presidency after 9/11 and create messages that would turn this president into a wartime president and would get the public to rally behind him. And that is what has sustained George W. Bush up until this point, and until his presidency has shown signs of falling apart.
We were just talking about evangelicals with Chip Roulette and a very strong voting bloc in the past. Now, you write in your book about how Karl Rove led the whole anti-gay marriage movement while protecting a family secret. What is that, James Moore?
Well, his family secret is that Karl's parents' marriage fell apart his senior year in high school. Karl's father had been a geologist throughout the Intermountain West and was gone a lot. And there's some indication that Karl resented that fact. He was not a child of Louis Rove. His biological father and his mother had divorced, but the only father Karl had known was Louis Rove, and he had raised Karl from the time he was very young, and his brother Eric. And then Louis Rove had three daughters with Reba Rove. But Carl, senior year in high school, his father landed a big job with Getty Oil in Los Angeles, and he was to come home on Christmas Eve and tell the family about the big plans to move down to Los Angeles and happily ever after moving from Salt Lake City. But there was an argument that ensued behind closed doors, and Louis Rove left, and he was not there for Christmas Day, which also happens to be Carl's birthday. And it turned out many years later that I found out about it, but Louis Rove went to Los Angeles and decided to live openly as a gay man. He had been gay all of his life, but had repressed it and had tried to live as a heterosexual, but he decided to live the second half of his life openly as a gay man. He retired to Palm Springs, California, and when he passed away, there was no... His friends, many retired gay men there who were close friends with Louis Rove, were unaware of any memorial service. Carl has taken exception with what my book says, that there was no public memorial service. Carl indicates, I'm trying to claim that there was no service at all whatsoever. That's not the case. However, it seems as though Carl was trying to suppress and continues to suppress the notion that, and the fact that the man who raised him, a man who he has said he had a loving, open, honest relationship with, was in fact a gay man. Carl buried his father, Louis Rove, in July of 2004. There was no public notice in the newspaper. And then he got on the campaign plane, and he went to 11 key swing states to help facilitate the anti-gay marriage amendment around this country, which drove turnout in the last election.
You've written a book about Karl Rove before, Bush's Brain, and now you've written this book a few years later. First of all, is that new information that you just revealed? And what else has, I mean, you have been investigating Karl Rove for years. What else have you uncovered in between the first and second book?
Well, what I just spoke to you about, yes, it is indeed new information. And there are any number of things that that have been revealed in the course of working on writing and reporting on Karl Rove. I first met him in 1978, and I recall after a television interview coming out and telling my cameraman at the time, this was the first time I had met Karl, and I told the cameraman, I said, look, if this guy ever gets any real power, we're all in trouble. And I think that that particular truth has been borne out, but there are a number of things that are quite disturbing. For instance, you were just talking briefly about religion, which is obviously an issue in every election, but since the Republicans have taken charge under George W. Bush, it's been a hugely significant issue. And it turns out that Karl Rove, the man who is the architect behind evangelical voters and their turnout in the voter delivery system of the Christian right, is agnostic. He doesn't have any deeply held faith. What people do not realize about this man is that everything about him is political utility. when he looked at what was going on with the mega churches, and when he did the polling and he saw how gay marriage was animating the Christian right, Carl decided he was going to take these gigantic churches and the Christian right and turn them into a gigantic vote delivery system. And that's precisely what he has done. This is not a man who has deeply held religious faith. It's a man who believes that faith can be used to drive voters to the polls. In fact, his own president, in an interview with unguarded moment aboard the press plane with my co-author Wayne Slater, had referred to the Christian right and the fundamentalists north of Austin as wackos. They hold these people in more disdain than these individuals are aware of.
Wait, explain exactly what happened on the plane.
Well, we were on the press plane and we were traveling, and this was early in the campaign, and Wayne Slater was standing next to the future president of the United States, and Wayne was talking about some of the issues in the first campaign, and what Wayne perceived to be the issues and what Wayne's personal beliefs might be at that particular moment, and how he arrived at those beliefs and what his analysis was. And Governor Bush just turned to him and he said, "Well, you know why you think that way. That's because you live up in Williamson County, north of Austin. You live up there around all those wackos." And that's not the first time we'd heard that reference privately.
James Moore, can you talk about Karl Rove's relationship with Jack Abramoff and the latest casualty, Susan Sure. Ralston, the top Rove aide, who had to resign?
Well, the thing that people have to understand about Carl Amy is that he has been building the Republican Party from a voter and donor list that he started creating on IBM electronic tape back in 1978. And any time he found people with money, he got their address, their phone number, and he put them on a log. And the tapes for the donation list for the Republican Party that are used by the RNC today grew from the germ that Carl created many, many years ago. People with money he's drawn to. He knows them. He knows their value and what they can do for him and the Republican Party. So the whole notion that a Jack Abramoff would come to Washington and be able to function and to move around that town and spread his money and his influence around without Karl Rove getting in front of him and saying, "Hey, wait a minute, pal, here's what you need to do and here's where your money needs to go," is nonsensical. I mean, nobody has been involved in the Republican Party without money who hasn't taken their traffic directions from Karl Rove. He had an ongoing working relationship with Jack Abramoff. It's outlined, a couple of incidents in our book are outlined in the way that they work together. For instance, it's obvious to anybody who has watched Carl and the president for years that they had an uncomfortable relationship with Tom DeLay, the former House Majority Leader, and they would use Abramoff to keep DeLay in line, and they would use Abramoff to make sure that the millions of dollars he had to donate were donated to the right candidates in the right places. And Susan Ralston had worked for Jack Abramoff. She was his office manager and business manager and did just about everything he needed to be done. And the next thing we know, she's in the White House working for Karl Rove. And there was so much scrutiny on this relationship, Carl was aware that someday somebody might look, so they conducted a lot of street corner meetings. They conducted a lot of meetings in restaurants or walking across the Capitol lawn. I mean, this is the kind of thing that Carl did not want to be publicly known and to be on the White House visitor records, but it's clear that there are many of them that were there, and I would suggest that for all of those that are on the White House logs, there's probably four or five or six times more that occurred elsewhere that are not recorded.
You have been following Karl Rove for a long time. He knows you and Wayne Slater.
Right.
What is his response to this book?
Well, he's angry about this book, as he was angry about Bush's Brain. When Bush's Brain first came out, he sent a 10-page single-space fax claiming that virtually everything in it was untrue. Unfortunately for Carl, the book has stood the test of time, and that's a pleasing thing to anyone who is a reporter or a writer. Now, the second book, he doesn't call me, but he does call Wayne, and the second book he called, and originally he did what Carl always does. He will send word through political operative in Texas who is a friend of his, who will then approach Wayne and will make his complaint to Wayne. And then Carl will eventually call Wayne and delineate what he believes are wrong, incorrect matters in the book. And always, everything that he points out is we don't write things that we don't have corroborated, that we don't have more than one source. And originally, he called and said, when he heard that we were writing about his relationship with his father, Louis Rove, who is gay, his response was not to attack the facts of the matter. His response was to do what Karl Rove always does and attack one of the primary on-the-record sources. And he took an individual who was one of his father's oldest and best friends of about 20 years, a man who described them as being closer than brothers, and a man who is a vice president of a major corporation, and he began to try to humiliate that man's background and suggest that he was nothing more than his housekeeper, when in fact he was a very successful man. This is the way Carl works, Amy. He attacks the messenger rather than the message to try to repudiate and discredit, and he has tried to dismiss this book as being a similar sort of thing.
The New York Daily News said that he wanted sections excised, taken out.
There's no question. He made these kinds of demands to Wayne. He asked that the publisher, Random House Crown, have its attorneys call his attorney and begin to get things straightened out. But there's nothing to straighten out. And my response was, if Carl wants to take on the book, have his attorney call the publisher and challenge it. But he didn't do that because he knows that'd draw more attention to the book.
James Moore, in this last minute we have, this is your second book on Karl Rove. What is, what have you learned at this point? What do you think is most significant before this midterm election?
I think, Amy, the thing that people need to know as we go into next Tuesday about Mr. Rove and the people that he leads in the Republican Party is that there is virtually nothing he will not do to continue to retain power and to win an election. Now, am I accusing Carl of being willing to do something illegal, unethical, or immoral? He's done all of those things in the past. It would not be anything new. In my heart, I hope that I want to believe that even Karl Rove, if he got to the point where he was doing something that was to violate the sanctity of our electoral process, he would back away from it. But I think everyone should be very, very concerned, and there should be attorneys in every one of the congressional districts in this country ready to file appeals, because I believe we're going to see a very ugly election day with lost data disks, voter suppression, people turned away from the polls who shouldn't be, and it's going to be an ugly day, I'm afraid.
Finally, the leaking of names of stories that made him such a target of investigators. We have 30 seconds.
Well, I think that this is the kind of thing that Carl does, and the kind of thing that is used for political purpose over and over and over, and nobody does it better than he does, and will continue to do it in ways that will help him and the Republican Party.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. James Moore, co-author of The Architect, Karl Rove, and The Master Plan for Absolute Power. That does it for our broadcast this weekend. I'll be in Barrie, Vermont at the Old Labor Hall as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour on Sunday, November 5th at 12:30. Also, we have the column has gone out, our Breaking the Sound Barrier column that any newspaper in the country can pick up. It's being distributed by King Features. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Matei, Jen Yuse, and we welcome Lee Burek to our production staff. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks also to Megan Whitney and Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.